Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The following big interview was posted in full for our socios, our members, our supporters, at patreon.com/GrahamHunter last season, which, in case you've forgotten, was 2018-19. Sign up there and you get these extra interviews 12 months in advance of everybody else, and who doesn't like to be ahead of the game? You'll have bonus content as well and a more interactive experience in general. For the rest of you, here's what the socios were listening to this time last year.
Hello, Groovers. Welcome to the big interview. It's me, Graham. Our guest this time is Mark Schwarzer, whose achievements with Middlesbrough, Fulham and Australia genuinely constitute the word legend. I meet Mark regularly across the Champions League at Mestalla at Camp Nou. He's broadcasting for Optus and doing brilliantly. The reason we chose him is that he had an elite career, set records, made European finals. But beyond that, he's a very bright, interesting man, a great storyteller. We begin with his early years in Germany and some wonderful, legendary players like Johnny Ekström, the Swede, Jens Jeremies, remember him from the all-conquering Bayern Munich team, and the push factors that brought him to the Premier League via Chris Kamara's Bradford. So, thank you to Mark, thank you to the Oatlands Park Hotel in Surrey for hosting us, and thank you to Luke and his team at False Nine Films who made this the first filmed big interview. Hope you've liked it, hope you've enjoyed it. There'll be more very soon, and in the meantime, thank you for everybody, every single person behind us getting the silver medal in Best Sport Podcast at the British Podcast Awards 2019. Love you all. We do this for you, Groovers. You see, you know me in the big interview by now. You know that I merit this gorgeous, lush, leafy garden. And it's a bit of a castle that we're recording this particular big interview in. And to complement that, to complement the luxury, the five-star beauty of where we are, we've gone to a six-star man. The idea that you're an international man, given your roots, which are German, Australian, you're bilingual at least, you are, a linchpin of why, you're an example of why the Premier League has become great over your career. And I wonder what, as an Aussie, how England's won your heart. Because that's not the easiest combination in the world.
I think for me it was very easy. I mean, I came from Germany to begin with. So I went from Australia to Germany for 2.5 years. And that period of time was a really difficult time. It was an unbelievable learning curve. One that I don't regret. I'm actually fortunate that I experienced how hard it was. But then the opportunity then came to come to England. And I just felt like I was coming home. There were so many similarities to being in Australia in terms of the mentality. I love so many things about England. That's why we decided to stay here. So from day one, I felt at home. I felt first and foremost, as a footballer, I felt valued when I came here, when Chris Kamara signed me back in the day.
He's coming up.
Just every time I put on a shirt to go and play, I just felt at home. I felt.
What does that mean about being valued and compared to what?
Well, when I went to Germany, it was back in 1994.
You're talking about Dresden originally.
I was in Dresden. turned up, and you know, it was 5 years after unification between East and West. There was a real divide between East Germans and West Germans, let alone foreigners. So you were classed as being, you're from the West, so you're kind of a foreigner. So there was a divide even amongst the team. So a lot of these guys, there was an opportunity to make a lot of money after the unification. They didn't want anyone from the West coming in and taking any of their positions, any of their jobs, their teammates.
We finally had a break in life. Things are going away, and look who's coming in now.
Yeah, that's right. And me coming from Australia, and then all just going, well, you know, he's got a German passport, but he speaks with his funny accent. He's from Australia. What do they know about football?
When you say funny accent, you were speaking in German.
I was speaking in German, yes. You couldn't, I mean, there was very few guys in the east part of Germany at that time that spoke in English. So I had to speak German. And I understood pretty much everything. Dealing with the accent, which was very different, the dialect, was very different in east part of Germany, in Sachsen, as the area is called, to what I was used to. My mum and dad sort of grew up around Stuttgart area, which is Schwäbisch.
It's also, I mean, geographically, in terms of wealth,
yes,
in terms of self-perception, it's extraordinarily different.
Very different. I mean, you know, you've got to go back in time and think about Second World War. 80% of Dresden was demolished. This is a country, a part of the world that was just rebuilding after unification. There were building sites everywhere. I remember going to a shopping centre and standing, looking, like wanting to buy something, and then looking over to the cash register, and there was a line about 20 metres long of people. And I just thought, what's going on here? Why is there no one else on any tills? And I looked over, there was another till about literally 20 metres away, and there was one person standing there, as in behind the till, waiting to serve people, but no one there. So basically what it was the locals were so indoctrinated about lining up, queuing for something, they just found it normal. They would stand in a queue because back in the time of communism, they would stand in queues for hours on end just to get bread, just to get the basic necessities. And they were doing the same thing then. This was 5 years afterwards. And it was a world away from what I was used to, being 21 years old, moving to Germany on my own, understanding a lot of the language but needing to learn it a lot better.
Did the city have any sort of Len Dayton feel to it, even though unification had come? Or was there still a concept of people looking at the inhabitants? Was there a dearth of goods?
No, there was an influx from the West, and there was, I think, too much too quickly for people to digest. And then there was this influx of a lot of Western investment. The city was being completely renovated. I think people were just, they were amazed at what it was like to be in a Western society. You know, things that were just at their disposal, like normal. It was easy to get that previously they never had. And I think that was the biggest. I mean, I remember another teammate there. He was from East Germany, and he was telling me stories about his mum and dad are both deaf. And they were I think his father was in the military, and they were on welfare in the east part of Germany. And he was saying that pre-unification, there was the Stasi police. So he was investigated all the time. Everyone was expected to spy upon each other. And he was telling me stories like it was proper spy stuff. So he'd receive a message, something like, I don't know, the sun is going to shine in the morning. And he knew what that meant.
That's a code.
That was a code. And he was expected to spy on a teammate. And in turn, he was being spied on. And everyone was spying on everyone. And they told him, they threatened him, they said to him, if you didn't, your parents would lose their benefits. And, you know, it was insane, the stories that you used to hear.
I don't want to move away from the social, but, like, you started to equate your feeling of comfort in England from having bridged from Sydney via Dresden and another place. But I can't, because I'm just self-indulgent, I can't go past Dresden without asking you about two guys. Jens Jeremies, who was about to bloom, and Johnny Ekström, who I think maybe his best days had come.
Yeah, it's right at the end of it.
Genuinely extraordinary footballers, neither of whom I've met.
Yeah, I mean, Johnny Ekström, the nicest man in the world. I mean, he came from Italy at the time, turned up, and, you know, he was just the most relaxed man in the world.
Bit of a specimen, I remember. I mean, Swedish, we're talking about, for those who don't know, Swedish centre-forward.
Yep.
I think Gothenburg had been his...
I think that's where he started off,
It's not a test. No. I think so.
If I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure it was.
If I'm wrong, Swedes, you know, tell me.
He, you know, he was a proven goal scorer. He was something that we genuinely needed a player to try and score goals for us in the Bundesliga. Dresden were always punching above their weight. It was a club that, behind the scenes, it was boiling over in terms of the way it was run. They had a president, that's another story altogether, who was always on the borderline or on an edge of legal and illegal dealings. And as it turns out, he ends up in prison not so long afterwards. The club pretty much loses its license and goes into amateur league because of it. But anyway, he was a phenomenal player. He was someone that everyone looked at as the person that was going to hopefully keep Dresden in the Bundesliga. And as we all know, one player not necessarily is going to do it. I mean, it can be a big influence, but he was never going to really, with the players that we had around. Jens Jeremies, he was a young kid coming through. I'm pretty sure I made my Bundesliga debut at the same time as he did, in the game against Eintracht Frankfurt.
Yeah.
And all heart and just an unbelievable engine. And he just ran and ran and ran. You know, he turned out to be a phenomenal player. I mean, he could see the signs already there at a very young age. Good kid. You know, someone who was so hungry to succeed.
He'd go on to be a motor of that extremely good Bayern Munich team,
yep,
reaching the Champions League final two, three times in the space of very short.
Yep.
And what seemed to me added to his game wasn't just that initial seek and destroy running power. Once he got the ball,
yes,
he actually became quite, without necessarily being Hoddle-esque, he became quite commanding about what once he'd won the ball high, he'd release it really well, and,
yes,
and people fed off him, I thought.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. No, he was really a diamond in the rough at the time, and it was very unfortunate for Dresden at the time to lose its license, to be relegated, lose its license, because I think, you know, he may have stayed a bit longer had they stayed in the Bundesliga, maybe not, but you know, he was a player that I think particularly Dresden will see as one of their own and be very fond of what he achieved.
So the president's not yet in jail, okay?
Nope.
It's Saturday the 6th of May, and by tea time on Saturday the 6th of May, 95. Was your dad a bit pissed off with you? Because Stuttgart came to town,
yeah,
with Thomas Berthold playing,
yeah,
Dunga playing, Gio Elber, Freddie, yeah, Bobic. Freddie Bobic, who's now, I think he's Eintracht Frankfurt director of football.
I think he might be. I could be wrong about that. Right.
And I don't know if that was your dad's team, Stuttgart.
It was.
And Jeremy scores.
Well, both the games I played in, I was very fortunate for a lot of reasons. My fortunate scenario was that we were pretty much almost relegated. And when I say that, I mean the president at that stage wasn't willing to spend a lot of money. So, and what that means is that at the time, internationals didn't have breaks in the league. So international teams were playing and they would have to go and they go and play their national team games and come back and they'd potentially miss games. Previously, up until those two games, the chairman or the president kept paying for a private jet for the number one goalkeeper, Stanislav Cherchesov, who is now Russia's national team coach, who managed them at the World Cup, Confed's Cup, and he was the number one goalkeeper. And he kept bringing him back very quickly after international meetings to make sure he was fit and ready to play for the games. And then because we looked like we weren't going to stay in the league, and I think maybe the manager at the time said to him, you know, you should give him a go, you know, regarding me. And for whatever reason, he decided not to pay for the private jet, and I ended up playing those two games. And I played really well in both of those games. And in both of those games, I felt very unfortunate to concede goals and lose against Eintracht Frankfurt, but also to concede very late against VfB Stuttgart. So, yeah, it was very, very disappointing, but I felt that I'd perform really well at that level.
Was there something riding on the game at all, the fact that it was your dad's team?
We still had a chance to stay in. Mm-hmm. So there was still hope that we could stay in the Bundesliga, and obviously we hadn't given up. So, you know, I thought, you know what, if I can come in here and make a difference and we can keep a clean sheet and we can even do the unexpected and win against a very, very strong VfB Stuttgart side, then you never know. Maybe I'll get a chance to keep my spot. But it wasn't to be.
The fact that Dresden prepared you for England,
yeah,
either that's the factor, Or Chris Kamara is the factor.
Well, I think it was the whole German experience. So it was Dresden to start with. We got relegated, then I moved on to Kaiserslautern. And again, it was that experience of Kaiserslautern. 18 months of it, the trials and tribulations of it, having an opportunity to play in the first team. Played well in my first game. Second game, okay. Third and fourth, I didn't play so well. And then I got, obviously I was out of the side, which is understandable. And then there was the teammates issue. There was a goalkeeper there, Gary Amman, who had been at the club forever. And he was living in the past, talking about every time we'd train on this on the stadium, he'd talk about a game against Barcelona. They beat Barcelona one time in a European Cup game. And he was 37 years old and didn't want to do the training, but wanted to sit on the bench each week because he would financially gain for it.
Okay, okay.
He would just, at every opportunity he had, he would put me down. So I got called up to the national team completely out of the blue. And it was something that I only got called up because I think it was Mark Bosnich at the time, pulled out last minute. And I was the closest one there and they called me up. And I remember coming in after training and I, as I walked in, Gary Amman talking to, I think it was Andreas Bremer. And they said, oh, did you hear, you know, Mark's been called up to the national team. And he went, what, for basketball? So that was kind of like forever, you were always put down. And I felt I was always being put down all the time. I never had the respect from my teammates. And that's a hard environment to be in. Mm-hmm. So you're continuously fighting, firstly, to have an opportunity to play on the team, but getting respect from your own teammates was almost non-existent for me. So that experience, and then we had Otto Rehhagel come in as manager, and he just didn't like young players at all. So I found myself being on the bench to being out of the team altogether. And when I asked him about it, he just said, well, we've got Gary Amman here. I want to see if he's still able to sit on the bench. I went, well, what, 37? You want to know if he can still sit on a bench? And I just went, I didn't understand it. And fortunately for me at the time, Hans-Peter Briegel was the team manager.
Okay.
So I went straight to see him. And
he must have been relatively young for a team manager.
He was quite young,
stage.
Yes, that's right. And I went, and it was one of his first jobs as being a manager of a club. So I went straight to him and I said to him, listen, you know, unfortunately, I've tried everything. This new manager does not care about young players. This is what my situation is. I need to get out of here. For the sake of my sanity, for the sake of my career, I need to leave. And he goes, okay, let me talk to the manager. I'll come back to you. So literally in a day or two, he came back to me, went to a meeting, and he said, I've spoken to the manager. The manager said, you can go. So that's all I needed to know. So from that point onwards, it was no longer about that team, that club. It was about getting myself right and ready to go on trial somewhere because I knew I had to go trial somewhere. And my prime objective was to try and get out of Germany and go to England.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Why England?
Because it was a league that I felt that goalkeepers were always respected and appreciated. And I knew the league. I followed it as a kid.
From TV?
All the time. We had some Australian players playing there. We had Mark Bosnich playing there. It was kind of the forefront of Australian goalkeepers overseas. John Phelan, Steve Mortone. We had a list of goalkeepers who were playing in England or at various clubs. So my wife wanted to work. She's got a degree in economics and majored in finance. So I wanted to go back into working. That was the best place for her to go. By chance, this national team call up. I spoke to various players, every player that was playing in England. So we had Lucas Neal, Harry Kewell, Kevin Muscat, Stan Lazaridis. All these guys were playing in England. And I was asking every one of them, who's your agent?
Kevin, in his part, was terrorising England rather
Absolutely.
Than just playing in England.
Absolutely.
I think it's worth making that clear.
Absolutely. And all of them came back with one agent, basically, who was helping Australian players. And it was Barry Silkman. And Barry arranged literally within a week a trial for me at Manchester City. At the time, was Steve Koppel was the manager, and I arranged everything for my club in Germany. And as fate would have it, the number one goalkeeper gets injured, so then I'm expected to sit on the bench because then I'm no longer number two. I'm number three. Had I been number two, I probably would have played in the second because Kaiserslautern at the time got relegated and were in the second division. And I potentially would have played. And who knows? My career may have taken a completely different turn. Who knows? But it wasn't to be. And they still allowed me to go, so long as I was back for each game. So I could go on a Sunday after a game. So long as I was back on the Friday, that was fine. So I managed to go to Manchester City and went on trial there for a week. Alex Stepney was the goalkeeping coach.
Oh, what a legend.
And he was brilliant. And I
Alex Hands, after the Champions League final in Glasgow, I met him and I talked to him because he was always punching and catching leather balls that were wet. Alex Hands are massive.
That's right.
Not as they were born,
no,
but bruised and battered and swollen.
And yeah, and funny how it is, you know, like the German connection always followed me. So I go to Manchester City and they had Ike Immel, Michael Fronsek, and Uwe Rösler at the club. And Ike Immel at the time was on the outer. And they were looking, they were desperately looking for another goalkeeper. So when they're on trial and I played, I trained with them and then I played a friendly behind closed doors and everything went really, really well. And they went, right, we need you back to play in a reserve grade game, in a proper official game.
Yeah.
So I went back to Germany and a couple of weeks later there was another reserve grade game coming up and I managed to come back over again and play in it. And who was it against? It was against Bradford City in Bradford. And funny enough, Phil Neal was the assistant manager, and he was taking the reserve grade.
Phil Neal, who won so many European Cups for Liverpool, fullback.
That's right. Yeah. And the story goes, he walked into the office where Chris Kamara was sitting and said to him, right, how good your team? Have you got a good team out there today? And he said, yeah, listen, I've got a pretty good team. I've got a pretty number of first-team players coming back from injury, some players just getting some games. And yeah, no, we've got a strong team. He says, great. He says, we've got this goalkeeper on trial, and he's been doing really well all week, and we really want to test him. Anyway, so I play the game, and I play really well, and we won 1-0, and we should have lost. But we won 1-0.
Because you played well, right?
I played well.
Okay.
And Chris Kamara got on to found out who my agent was and called him straight after the game and said, we want him. So I was kind of like sitting there, and it was ironic again. I was sitting in the bus, and we got a whole lot of fish and chips delivered to us on the bus. And I just couldn't believe it. I was just like, this is amazing. This is what I'm missing. And my agent rang me and said, listen, I've got Bradford City on the phone and they want you to come in. I said, listen, I said, that's great, fantastic. I said, but we've got to do the right thing by Manchester City first and foremost. They brought me over. They have first opportunity to see whether they want to sign me. And anyway, so it went on for a while. And then apparently what happened was I spoke to Steve Coppell the next day. He told me they wanted to buy me. I was £155,000 to buy outright.
That's a chunk of change at that stage.
It was okay. It was very reasonable. And Steve Coppell apparently was promised £10 million at the time to buy players when he first went to Man City. And I was apparently like the third or fourth player that he tried to sign for little money, and the club kept saying, no, you can't, you can take him on loan. And I refused to go anywhere on loan. I wanted a clean break from Germany.
Play for somebody that's shown they want you.
That's right. 2 days later, Steve Coppell resigned.
He didn't last long.
Apparently was the final one where he wasn't allowed to buy, that he walked and went, there's no point. So Phil Neal took over, still wanted to sign me, but at this stage the club was in disarray.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a contract signed over, there was a zero missing off figures, it was a nightmare. And in the end, at this point, it had dragged on for probably a good 4 or 5 weeks, and then Bradford were hot on to it.
They were ready, were they?
And they again wanted to loan me. I said, no chance, I need to go permanently. So they went, okay, we'll buy you. At this stage, then we decided, you know what, only fair is fair now. Man City have had enough opportunity to buy me. They couldn't sort themselves out. And I ended up signing for Bradford City.
I used to work at Sky as on Revista and come in from Spain and see Chris Kamara around quite a lot. And we'd stayed in the same hotel once. I saw him at reception. He was going on out. And he said, I'm going out to sing. I said, oh, brilliant. Are you a karaoke singer? And I swear to you, he because, you know, Chris is a sort of English version of Sinatra.
Yes, that's right.
And he's a professional singer.
That's right.
But so I'm asking you now, as a first-time witness, can he sing?
Yeah, I think he can, yeah.
Did he ever sing to you as manager?
No, not as manager. So he was a different Chris Kamara as a manager than he is now. You saw glimpses of what he is now as a manager.
Meaning?
Well,
the ebullience or the...
He was very emotional. He was up and down like this all the time. I remember one game we played away at Crystal Palace and we were winning 1-0 and we were being bombarded. And I was coming out, taking crosses and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, they scored 2 late goals. One was from a cross. I can't remember the other one. Anyway, after the game, he's come in and he's lambasted me and said, you should have come out and taken that cross. I mean, this is a game where I came out and took everything. And I think that's the problem. The problem was I kept coming out and taking stuff. And then when someone scored from a header, he's like, well, how come he's in taking that one? So he lambasted me and I just went, gaffer, from my perspective in that game, I don't believe I could have. But unless you tell me otherwise, and go and watch on the video, you tell me that, then I'll hold my hand up. But I said, from my understanding of it in the game, I don't think I could have come for it. Anyway, fast forward at training the next day, calls me up and says, listen, you're right, I'm sorry. So it was just emotional all over the place.
That's very good.
It was very good.
That's unusual.
There's very few managers that can do that.
They won't back down because they see... even if they've been wrong, they see it as a, as undermining their own authority.
He was great. And I listen, my experience with Chris Kamara was brilliant. I mean, he's a manager that I knew believed in me. He trusted me. Of course, I performed for him, but it works two ways because you know that someone believes you. It's like me going to Fulham with Roy Hodgson. I knew, and Mike Kelly and Ray Lewington, I knew they had my back. They believed in me. And even if I made a mistake, I'd come in and go, listen, guys, I'm really sorry. I made a mistake. They go,
above any position in that football team, a keeper knowing that is paramount.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this whole thing about swapping and changing, I don't ever see it working out that well. I find it just creates so much uncertainty amongst the goalkeepers. And I think we saw it at Liverpool a couple of seasons ago with Karius and Mignolet. They end up having two goalkeepers that don't perform well because they don't know whether one mistakes you out of the team.
See, I grew up when England couldn't decide between Shilton and Clements.
Yep.
And they rotated them.
Yes.
Not all the time,
yes,
but very regularly, particularly Ron Greenwood. And nobody else around Britain was doing that
no.
at all. You had a first-choice goalkeeper, second-choice goalkeeper. Because they were so good, it seemed to work. I know that it certainly wasn't what either of them wanted, but, and again, it's not a club side, so maybe there's a slight difference.
I get it, because you're playing week in, week out for your club, and then when you get together from internationals, it works.
You're still, in between, you're still getting the hard action
yes.
that you need.
Yes, you are. And whereas at a club, you're not. You know, you're in and out all the time, and it does play on you. And goalkeepers, it's like any player, you need a run of games to play yourself into a game. Today it's even harder because when I went to Chelsea, I was at the latter stages of my career, but Jose Mourinho said to me, listen, I want two goalkeepers that I know I can rely on. Obviously, Petr Cech's number one, you're coming as a number two, but you will play enough games. Because at the time, I was still playing in the national team and I wanted to go to the World Cup in 2014.
14, yeah.
You know, and then what ended up happening towards Christmas time, he actually apologised to me and said, you haven't played the amount of games I thought you'd play. And a lot of that was to do with the fact that Petr never got injured
mm-hmm.
that season
mm-hmm.
until right at the end. Every other season up until that point, he was injured a number of times throughout the course of the season. But for whatever reason, that season, he didn't get injured until Champions League semi-final away at Atletico Madrid. It was hard. So for me, it was always hard that when you get a chance, you have to try and perform, because if you don't, then they start to ask questions. Is the second goalkeeper the right one? Because he can't just come in and play. He can't play at the level we need
to
play.
So this is the first leg, right?
Yeah.
I would honestly say, now not from an English perspective, because I've learned to distance myself from the English media, which is like, English team against somebody else, well, we're going to win a quarter.
Yeah.
I still think Chelsea probably went into that tie slight favourites.
Yeah, possibly. I mean,
think about squads and manager.
Madrid had a very strong home record in the Champions
League.
There was definitely no sense of taking for granted and underestimating the opposition. We knew they were a very good side. And we were really happy with a 0-0 draw away from home. Obviously, we'd have loved to have scored a goal, but the way the game unfolded, losing Petr, when you lose an influential player like that, it can be the downfall of a team.
But you were ready in every way, given what you've gone through. No nerves, no worry about your form.
No, it was kind of like, you know what, this is what you trained for, this is what you've been brought in for, just go out there and play.
Did you ever look out the corner of your eye about, here's Costa?
No.
He's a bully.
I enjoyed it. It was actually one of my favourite games to have played in. I loved it. It was a lot of.
I was going to say that the Calderon is your type of stadium.
Yeah,
too.
It was brilliant. There was a lot of balls into the box, high balls. There was a lot of confrontation. There was a lot of 50-50 challenges. Costa was always in there. I love that. I mean, you look at throughout my career in the Premier League, and often I bump into Dion Dublin, and we all often joke about there's very rarely that contact in the box anymore between a goalkeeper and a big centre forward.
They bring in the international core of human rights, don't they? Now
we used to have the biggest tussles, Peter Crouch, when you used to go to Stoke and come up against that Stoke front, the whole team, how big they were. Shawcross came up front, Walters and the rest that come in the box, and they bombard you, they run into you, they do all sorts to you. Dungan Ferguson at Everton, they talk about that FA Cup game when he played Bradford City against
Well, you won 3-2 at Goodison.
We won 3-2, but
Duncan was a different kind of...
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. You just had to be nice to him. It killed him if you're nice to him. If you fought with him, he loved it, and he wanted to rip your head off, and you didn't want to mess with him because he's that type of character. But if you were nice to him, he didn't know how to deal with it. It was almost like, this guy's a nice guy. I don't want to hurt him. But if he had a reason then to
fight
me. It's
just as well that comment was never released during his career because you could have ruined his life.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, but a lot of us knew. Like, it was like, right, just be nice to Duncan. Don't, you know, just tell him.
Don't get under his skin.
Talk about his pigeons. Talk about everything else.
He loves them more than life itself, doesn't he?
So it was like, just don't make him angry. When I was younger, I fell into the trap a few times and he bumped into me and or you know, a slight bit of an elbow and you had a go at him and he just like, you see that look, those eyes.
It's me and you for the next 70 minutes, mate.
It was like, and then afterwards it was like, oh, what have I just done? That was a wrong move. Yeah, so I did it a few times and yeah, he let you know.
Player who you kind of know is going to run in, and if he can't get the ball, you know he's going to catch you as you're up there and do that.
Yeah.
Take you from about the thigh, if you go in hard on the thighs where you're off the ground, there's going to be a sort of cartwheel effect.
Yeah.
And whether you get the foul or the card or whatever, it's you and Mother Earth and the ball. And
I broke my back doing it.
I was going to say, there's going to be breakages.
I broke my back at Swansea. Routledge, ball came far post, and as I came out to take it, he stopped and turned and bent over.
Yeah.
And it flipped my legs over. And I flipped over and I landed on my shoulders and my neck, and my legs flipped back, and I fractured my T9.
Sorry. T9?
So on the spinal cord, so your vertebrae, not the spinal cord, but on the spine.
I wish I hadn't asked now.
T9.
I think I knew, but...
So top 10% of it. So and what that bone does is it crumbles. It doesn't break in terms like when you break your arm.
Is it like a shock absorber?
Yeah, it's kind of like, it ends up being like that. Yeah, and it crumbled the top 10% of it. Obviously, I was seen to on the pitch, and you don't think that. You know, I'm like, oh, I've hurt my back. It's a bit sore. Can I keep... Yeah, it's actually like, I think I can keep going. I end up finishing the game. And I got assessed after the game by the doc, and the doc went, nah, listen, I don't think it's anything too serious. Then I went to training on the Monday, and I was like, nah, this is not right. I need to go and get it checked. So they sent me for a scan and went straight into the specialist office, and he went, right, he says, you need a break. Like, what do you mean? Like, just for a couple of days. He went, no, you can't play for another couple... You know, you won't be able to play for another couple of weeks now. And I went, because you might not walk off. And I went, what do you mean? I won't walk off and I'll be all right. And he goes, no, you might not walk ever again. I went, okay, I'll take a rest. And the thing was, at the time, my contract was so I had to play 90% of the games up until Christmas for me to get another extension.
Renewal, yeah.
And there were 4 games left. I needed to play 1 game to get 90% of the games. Obviously, I didn't make it. I was from the injury to playing again, it was 10 weeks. I was back playing in 10 weeks. But the club were brilliant. After 4 weeks, after the second scan and seeing the specialist, and the specialist went, Eric's fine, you'd be great, they renewed my contract.
But there were clubs and executives who'd stiff you on that.
Absolutely.
Hopefully you enjoyed that big interview, which was first released as an exclusive to our socios 12 months ago. If you'd like to get these interviews on the first day that they're available, it's time for you to join us, to become a socio, and for only £2.99 a month, you will get an exclusive big interview, plus regular mini-documentaries, not only all ad-free, but all featuring me, and bringing you interesting, funny, and sometimes scandalous things from Spanish football. Go to patreon.com/GrahamHunter to unlock our entire archive. That means that once you join, you will have a treasure trove of interviews with funny, elite, interesting, revelatory, top-class footballers. By joining us, you will help support this independent podcast. You will help to keep us on the road, interviewing people and sending that content for your delectation. If you go to the gym, you'll be slimmer. If you've got a dog, he or she will thank you. If you've got a TV, you can turn it off and listen to this instead.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.